This is Norm Diamond. I'm speaking this morning with Christian Araos. Christian is the co-chair for the Americas of DSA, of the Democratic Socialists of America. Welcome this morning to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Christian.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
Very glad to have you. I should add that you come as well from Chilean extraction.
Yes, my parents migrated in the 80s when they were young. I've been in New York my whole life, but definitely had my heart and intellectual curiosity with Chile and my taste as well.
Well, let's begin with Chile today. We're going to end up focusing on 50 years ago and the coup against Allende. But that coup resonates still. It does around the world. And it does specifically in Chile. Let's talk about both those aspects.
Right. I think to start with the world and the United States as well, and a lot of Western society, with the concerns over the strength of democracy at the moment, we've seen plenty of talk of threats, militarized threats, fascistic threats to democracy, to constitutional rule of order emerge in the past few years. And I think that motivates some of the sentiment towards commemorating the coup. I think that was where it resonated, especially in North America and the US and Canada in particular. And for the diaspora, it's a mix of that and the personal history of the coup, and knowing especially if you're of a left or social democratic persuasion, it's probably the most formative event of political consciousness for so many people. And I think that also expands to North Americans of any leftist. It's an extremely formative event for the US's role in it, the transnational corporation role in it, and broader Western countries' support for either, expanding not just to the UK, but West Germany as well played a part. Brazil played a part in supporting the overthrow of Salvador Allende. I think it's a completely different matter when you domestically within Chile, though, because of a variety of factors. We have a broad idea of how much of the fact that there was foreign influence in the coup, there was domestic factors as well, but the exact details, the exact portionment is still very much a hot debate. And because of that murkiness, it's easy for the right to obstinate, deny, be contradictory, or just justify the coup. Just in the past week, there's been various stances from right-wing figures who refused to sign onto President Boric's declaration to commemorate the coup, to vow for it to never happen again. Eventually, former President Sebastián Piñera signed the declaration, but he's not going to participate in the commemoration ceremonies proper. The far right party also is just not going to participate in it at all. We probably will see them celebrate or post some laudatory remarks on that day.
Laudatory about Pinochet or about the fact of the coup in favor of it.
Exactly. During the last presidential campaign, the right wing candidate said this was the day Chile chose liberty. So that'll be the type of sentiment you'll see from right-wing circles that day.
So still controversial, still alive in Chile. Your assessment about kind of the world reaction, I want to add something to it. You gave a very modest assessment, actually, about the significance. There's another dimension, and that's not just about the challenge to democracy or the challenge of authoritarian regimes that, of course, we're all facing in the world now. But Allende stood for something else beyond that. And that was there a peaceful path to socialism? And I certainly remember the controversies at the time. Was that even possible? And of course, the coup against Allende seemed to be an argument that that chosen path was an extremely difficult one, if possible at all.
So when we look at the 50s, 60s, 70s, that mid-20th century where armed struggle managed to preserve socialism in Latin America, in Cuba, Nicaragua, what have you, and electoral peaceful paths were crushed brutally with the help of the United States, of course, I think we're starting to see that flip where now there's a consensus for peaceful struggle within the contours of democracy. There's not really a large appetite and interest for the vanguardian armed struggle as a means for securing change. That's a long debate to have and why that factors have changed. But certainly, I think in terms of Allende's legacy, it serves as a forerunner, really, to this sort of mass struggle for social democracy that now you've seen his successors in Chile, Brazil, and elsewhere build upon and seek to preserve. So Allende was really just the first of his kind, and I guess that's how his legacy perseveres.
Now, I would argue that Allende's objectives probably went beyond the kinds of objectives, the kinds of policies, certainly the kinds of accomplishments that we're seeing from those who followed his path. So let's go back 50 years and talk about what Allende, who he was, what he was after, and what he actually did accomplish in the 3 years that he held the presidency. And of course, we're not talking just about one person. We're talking about a movement that he was part of and led.
Yeah, for sure. In his early life, he was a physician by trade. And as a student, he was elected vice president of the University Student Federation. It's the same body that exists. It's been around for over 100 years. It elected Gabriel Boric its president a decade ago. It's elected Camila Vallejo, who is now a senior minister in the government. So it's an institution, a legacy institution for socialists, the student movement that you know encompasses his generations. Allende co-founded the Socialist Party when he started as a deputy, built himself on workplace reforms, childcare initiatives, and all this is built upon his path as president. He supported nationalization. He expanded nationalization to the U.S.-owned copper mines. And to this day, despite the dictatorship, despite the return of democracy and everything, Chile still has nationalized copper. And he expanded also to privately owned coal mines as well. And using that, he funded initiatives that helped child development. Free milk distribution is probably the most noteworthy. And an overall expansion of social safety net. He also expanded land reform and eliminated the feudal land policies that governed rural Chile. And as a result, landowners no longer had free labor from tenant farmers. That vestige of colonial Spain was eliminated once and for all. And to harken back to that connection with the student movement, he also expanded co-governance in universities and gave students greater power over education policy. And we all know that all these accomplishments were despite pressure and the asymmetric warfare that the Nixon administration launched and from sabotage from the upper classes within Chile as well.
One of the reforms, one of the accomplishments that always stood out for me was building vacation facilities for workers on the coast, taking kind of prime coastal real estate and building cabins for just ordinary workers to have access to on their vacation.
It was, yeah, all these little things that Allende's career around, especially workers, workplace reform, work life, was so critical for him to build that popular support. And it's, like I mentioned, it encompassed every facet from their vacation time to their safety within the workplace, child labor, All these components that, you know, we in the US just fought and struggled for 100, 110, 120 years ago. It took until the mid 20th century for countries in Latin America, like Chile, to implement and expand upon.
Many of which we do not have still.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, the program for that you mentioned, milk for every kid in the country. That's something that's sorely needed here. We don't have that. Healthcare, no, for all, et cetera.
Yeah. When he was a deputy, Allende was one of the drafters for universal healthcare. And, you know, even now, there is still a state provider of healthcare in Chile. It's forced to share space with private insurance companies, but at the same time, though, that private marketplace, actually a bit of a proto-Obamacare format of what was built in after Allende's removal, still exists, but also that state healthcare is still there and has the potential to outlast the private marketplace, given some current situations going on with Chile's healthcare sector. All these little initiatives that he made that the dictatorship and neoliberalism sought to snuff out still managed to survive in some way to be built upon.
Okay. This is a brief period in, I don't want to say in power, because we want to talk about the forces opposing him too and what he wasn't able to accomplish. But let's start out. How was it possible for him even to win, to get to that position? And what were the forces behind him? And what were the forces opposing him?
Well, it took persistence. This was his fourth presidential campaign in 1970 that he finally won. And like in his previous campaigns, he was the unquestioned candidate of Popular Unity, which was the coalition of communists, socialists, and Christian leftists as well. This is where you're starting to see obviously in the 80s, you'd see liberation theology be a key component in Central America. It did exist in Chile in the 60s and 70s as well. And in terms of makeup, demographically, we're looking at young adult professionals, students, trade unionists, rural land workers, really. And in an election in 1970, he lost the largest urban cities, Santiago, Valparaíso, but he still collected enough support within from those young urban workers and students to not lose by that much, despite the more popular support that other candidates received from older and wealthier residents. And then he just swept up smaller cities and rural Chile. And in that era, this was a first-past-the-post election. So with three candidates that all received, you know, at least 30% of the votes, Allende only won the overall vote with 36%. In that constitution, how it went was the top two candidates who, if no one failed to reach a majority, the Congress was to decide between the two candidates that got the most votes. So it was him and the right-wing candidate, Jorge Alessandri. And the norm was for Congress to follow the vote that the people had made. They ended up doing that in Allende's case, but during the interim, this is where he saw the Nixon administration begin its campaign against Chile. You know, the first thing was to pressure Congress into not ratifying the vote, and straight from the onset, begin plans for a coup. And this is the story of René Schneider's death, his attempted kidnapping and murder. And it was because, just for a brief bio, he was the head of Chile's armed forces and was also an avowed constitutionalist. He was not going to break the constitution for personal gain. After his death, it was untenable for the Congress, for the right, to not vote for Allende. The whole incident surrounding his attempted kidnapping and murder shocked Chile. And
I did not realize that there were good consequences coming out. I mean, we knew that Schneider was a supporter of the constitutional process, and that the military therefore would have backed the chosen candidate. And so it seemed like his assassination, Schneider's assassination, was a step backward. But you're saying that that's part of what enabled the Congress, part of what forced the Congress to select Allende as the president.
That, and also Allende struck a deal with the Christian Democrats to, as his own constitutional protection pledge. Allende did get some criticism for compromising with the Christian Democrats, but at the same time, it was enough to secure his support. And with the events of Schneider's death and the agreement, it was enough for him to receive the ratification comfortably. So it was a combination of politics and the events kind of diffusing what could have been, you know, a thwarted attempt for him to even be inaugurated, let alone hold power.
Okay, forces opposing Allende.
Your traditional wealthy elites, for sure, especially domestically. There was probably the most noteworthy that stood out, especially in this week while in Chile, there's been events commemorating the coup, a lot of news programs, etc. The owner of El Mercurio, one of the largest newspapers, was a key liaison, especially in the period we're just talking about here, after Allende's, the vote for Allende in September of 1970 and the ratification in October. The owner of El Mercurio was a key liaison between Washington and domestic forces in Chile. And from that also started the business class resistance. And with that came funding for militant far-right extremists through that network domestically. Obviously, Allende was also not popular with the Catholic Church as well, especially for the attempt for land reform, so landowners as well. So it was a genuine class construction. And then also there was moderates who were concerned about socialism gaining hold, but were at least enough of them from 1964 to 1970 either sided with Allende or were muted overall, or were satisfied with Allende willing to compromise with the Christian Democrats to support. But, you know, we're talking about just your moderate voter who's pro-social reforms, saw some of the nationalization already taking place before 1970, but just didn't want to go completely all the way with an open Marxist. But that's the broad contour from your moderate to your extreme opposition for Allende.
Domestically. And then, yes, of course, we've got AT&T, big U.S. conglomerate. And elsewhere in the program, I will give the exact quote, but I can't resist the famous Henry Kissinger quotation about how the people of Chile cannot be allowed democratically to vote what they think is in their own best interest. It's better the way he said it. But
the documents from the National Security Archive are especially revealing of Kissinger's nature with regards to Chile, especially condescending. Obviously, Nixon's reputation for his temperament was noteworthy, but behind the scenes, it's Kissinger who was chairing the meetings, providing strategic advice, and just plotting the entire time in this, and was really the one who motivated Nixon's reasoning the most in this anti-communist realpolitik that was incredibly cynical. Then some of this stuff is just starting to come out. There's a documentary that came out last week in Chile that's actually was available to stream anywhere in the world. And it's just pouring through the documents from the archive. And this is all, you see Kissinger be very, very frank this entire time about wanting to suffocate Chile's democracy straight from the onset, straight from once the results were known.
And even ahead of time, in prior, when Allende was running and losing in prior elections. They saw this moderate socialist, they saw him as somehow the pathway to communism. Not too long ago, I prepared an obituary for Kissinger that I was going to air on the radio. And then I discovered he's still alive. He's about 100 years old. We will deal with him when the inevitable happens. Christian, any last word about today in Chile? As we speak, we're 4 hours different time zone from Chile, so all kinds of events are going on. It's potentially a dangerous day in Chile, too. We could get news of strife.
Yeah, it's important to know that because of the fact that it was the end game of what had been a years long political struggle and internal battle, that the event itself is not going to carry that universal gravity. You know, obviously the date is shared with what happened in the United States in 2001. Where that's kind of a universally felt tragedy in one way or another. People mourn in different ways and understand that something very bad happened to the overall nation on that day. Contrast that in Chile, where there are sectors who are openly going to celebrate this day as something an unmitigated good for Chile, and others who are affected by the tragedy, who either sentimentally or who ended up losing people in the violence that followed or in the dictatorship that followed. So we should always be aware that this is going to be, that there may be strife, there may be hot debate. And also at the same time, this is a country that right now is struggling to avoid an economic recession. It has unemployment problems. It has a whole slew of issues surrounding its major sectors across the entire country. So for people who maybe were not around in 1973, you know, this is just, their lives are right now what's more important. So the anniversary and the events just kind of linger in the background or something that can be tuned out, as is often the case here as well. I mean, there's people I'm sure who don't feel inclined to participate in commemorations of 2001. So it's a very similar dynamic going on. And it's been a problem for the government because for people who are too young, you know, ritual ceremonies aren't the thing that's going to motivate them. But at the same time, it's an incredibly important thing to have the state commemorate the event and have it be the official position of the state that this was an anti-democratic tragedy that occurred.
As you began our conversation by pointing out, not just what it represents historically, the coup against Allende, but the way in which it continues to structure possibilities. Yeah, within Chile, it continues to resonate in very concrete kinds of ways as well, and including in programs that continue and social divisions that continue. Christian, I want to thank you for being with us this morning. We could talk a lot further, I think, about contemporary Chile. Pay attention to the news. See what happens today. And we'll continue following events in Chile. And very possibly, Christian, talk again.
I would love to. It's been a pleasure.
Good. That was Christian Arauz. This is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.